We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Humanity has struggled to understand and to treat cancer for thousands of years, and that's certainly a sobering reality for anyone who is trying to answer the big question, where are we in the war against cancer? In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He is a cancer physician and researcher. He is also the author of the book, The Emperor of All Maladies. The subtitle is A Biography of Cancer. The book was first published by Scribner's last year. It is now out in paperback. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and it's a sterling attempt at a rather daunting task, that is, telling the story of cancer from the earliest accounts of the disease to the present. And he says he hopes that perhaps by demystifying the disease that we can get close to answering that question, can we imagine cancer's end? Our guest is assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, also a cancer physician at the CU-NYU Presbyterian Hospital. And he's joining us by phone. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Dr. Mukherjee, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. You know, I was really struck by something that you said in a talk that I saw, one of the book talks that you gave. And I think it's very striking where you were talking about how much the relationship between a doctor and a patient is about telling stories back and forth. And that's something that in addition to trying to provide some answers to the big questions about cancer in the book, that's really what the book is all about. Telling stories.
I think that's absolutely true. The relationship, medicine can come across as a very abstract discipline to patients. You know, there are CAT scans happening and MRIs and procedures and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But one has to remember, and I think I have to remember, that every medical encounter begins with storytelling, which is that a patient comes to a doctor, and the first thing that the first exchange of information that occurs is not, what was your laboratory result or what did the scan look like, but the first exchange is usually and appropriately, what's the problem? How can I help you? Tell me a story.
Yeah, and I'm also really struck by how important metaphors are as a storytelling aid, it goes all the way right back to the beginning, where you tell the story of how it is that how the word cancer, how it was coined, how it comes from the Greek word for crab, because Hippocrates, the man who came up with that, thought it was looking at a tumor, and he thought that's what it looked like.
Exactly, and in fact, that's what connects cancer with the astrological sign, because once again, looking at the heavens, some astronomer also thought that the constellation of stars looked like a crab. And it's a reminder, I think, to us about how metaphorical language constantly is. As you're saying, the word cancer comes about because Hippocrates and others imagined that a tumor was like a crab buried underneath the skin. And the blood vessels, the swollen blood vessels around the tumor, were like the legs of the crab. And that name, it's a very unusual metaphor. If you think about it today, certainly it would be hard for us to invent this metaphor for cancer. But yet the word and the image is so vivid that it sticks with us. We cannot look at a crab in some ways without thinking about the different meanings of cancer.
Yeah. Another important metaphor has been the way we talk about cancer has been the war metaphor, and one of the things that you deal with in the book is the history of the quote-unquote war on cancer, and that makes me wonder whether that metaphor is really helpful to trying to understand what cancer and the fight against cancer is really all about.
Well, it's a complicated question, and I'd like to spend some time talking about it because it's an important question. Mm-hmm. The notion of fighting a war against any illness, any disease, is not, of course, restricted to cancer. It comes long before cancer. We fought wars against polio, for instance. And I think the important message here is that people have very different reactions to the metaphor. Very famously, as a background, the cultural critic, but very importantly, cancer patient herself, Susan Sontag, has made a very compelling argument that metaphors can be burdensome. If you are fighting a war as a patient and you don't survive or you have a relapse, then does it mean that you're a loser? And can that itself be a burden, a psychological or psychic burden, that ultimately your illness takes on forms that are far deeper than just the physical and goes into the metaphysical realm? And so Susan Sontag wrote very movingly about this and talked about how tuberculosis, TB, was overburdened with metaphors. You know, to be a victim of TB, you had to be a particular way. You had to have a poetic temperament. You had to have, you know, you were suffering, and that suffering somehow cleansed you. But, of course, all this was nonsense. So that's the background. Now, that having been said, I have to say that many patients want the metaphor of war. There's a very moving article today in the New York Times by a friend and a cancer patient, Daniel Menaker, who talks about, and people might be interested in reading it, who talks about the fact that for him, he wanted the metaphor. He needed that metaphor of war for his survival. He concludes very nicely by quoting Churchill. He says, you know, Daniel is undergoing chemotherapy for lung cancer. And he says, you know, I will fight the cancer in the mediastinum. I will fight the cancer in the pleura. I will fight it in the lymph nodes. I will fight it in et cetera, emphasizing that metaphorical concept of fight. So I think it's different for different patients. Some people want the metaphor of war. Some people dislike it. They find it burdens them. And there's no archetypal patient, so why should there be an archetypal metaphor?
Yeah. Well, I think that also one of the things that makes this whole business really difficult, people talked about it at the time, and I think you talk about it in the book. Perhaps the thing that began you on this journey was dealing with a patient who said to you, look, doctor, I think that I can do this. I think I'm up to this. But what I need to know is, what is it that I'm up against? And that seems to be always the big question. Even when the war on cancer was declared, a lot of researchers said, you know, following the idea that in war, if you're going to win, you have to know your enemy, they said, wait a minute, we can't even talk about launching a war on cancer because we don't know enough.
Right. I mean, there's a very important tension which really rides through the entire book. And I have to say the tension really exists today as well as a clinician. And that is the tension between doing something now or waiting until you've figured out all the pieces and then acting on that information. I'll just give you an example. You know, a woman who has breast cancer, when she is presenting to you, talking about her illness and treatment in the clinic, you cannot tell her, well, come back to me in 5 years when we figured out what to do about, you know, how your breast cancer works, such that we can then direct some specific therapy. She needs treatment now. And that's the clinician's urgency. The clinician faces a very different kind of problem than the laboratory researcher who has the luxury. The laboratory researcher can go back to the laboratory and she can figure out exactly how the cancer cell works and maybe 10 years from now come up with a treatment. But the woman, the patient, is in the clinic now and does not have the luxury of waiting for 5 years or 10 years. And that, of course, is the urgency of the entire situation. And in 1971, there were people who said, look, you know, we can certainly wait, but we need to launch this war now because patients are dying and we need to find mechanisms to help them. And maybe we don't need all the information in order to get effective chemotherapies.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He is a cancer physician and researcher, and he is also author of the book The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. The book first was published last year and has just come out in paperback. It's published by Scribner. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the big ideas I think that it's good for people to understand is that cancer, despite the fact that we might think of cancer as a modern disease, we know that cancer has been around for a long time, and in fact, we have accounts of what probably was a case of breast cancer going all the way back to ancient Egypt.
Absolutely, and the great irony is that we think of cancer as a modern disease, but in fact, if you look at the medical records, probably the most ancient diseases that we know about include cases of cancer. Not only in Egypt, as you're pointing out, so the Egyptian case is particularly instructive. Mm-hmm. The Egyptian case comes from a document which is one of the very oldest medical documents known in human history. That's quite recent because we weren't writing history until quite recently. So it goes back to 2500 BC, which is 4,000 odd years away. But the very first medical documents that we know about talk about diseases that resemble breast cancer. And the description is very vivid. It's case 45 in this very beautifully written medical papyrus called the Edwin Smith Papyrus. And it describes breast cancer as a mass in the breast which is hard and cold, like the hemat fruit, a particular kind of fruit that you could find in Egypt. And it's a very vivid description of breast cancer. In fact, even today, my students and I, when we examine a case of breast cancer, I always remind them to look for that sort of hard, dense, somewhat cold-feeling mass which resembles the hemat fruit.
And in this particular case, the note of the physician, whoever this was, this Egyptian physician, was that he examined the patient, he made this diagnosis, and then had to say to her, I'm sorry, but there's nothing that I can do.
Absolutely, and it's a very humbling note, too. If you read all the cases, there are about 40-odd cases in this papyrus. First of all, it should be essential reading in human history. It has nothing to do with the human cultural history. Of course, people in medicine are particularly interested in this papyrus, but it is an amazing record of what human beings could or could not do 4,000-odd years ago. The physician is Imhotep. He's a scribe. Whether he's one person or many people's collected wisdom, we don't know. But in every case in this ancient Egyptian papyrus, he puts down a little bit about therapy. So, for instance, in their neurosurgical cases, head wounds, broken bones, fractures, diseases of the teeth and the jaw, and typically he has something to give, a poultice or a remedy of some sort. Go take this herb or bind the face of the neurosurgical victim in this way or that way. But for this one case, it is the only case in which he says, I have no treatment. And it's very humbling because, to some extent, now breast cancer is a disease whose physiognomy has changed dramatically. It's one disease where survival has inched forward inch by inch by inch by inch for the last decades. But that said, there are certainly cases that I see still today in which I have to go back to Imhotep's words and I say, I'm sorry, there's not very much more that I can do.
Mm. I have a caller here, and again, for people who are listening, if you have questions for our guest, you certainly could be bringing your thoughts and questions to us. You can do that very easily by calling us 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have somebody who is calling on a cell phone, so we'll go right there to our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. I wanted to maybe kind of offer the doctor kind of an overview, maybe a philosophical approach, and certainly free to comment on it. I think the treatment of cancer, obviously, and the doctor would know this better than me, they've made great strides in over the years. That's probably overstating the obvious. I had an uncle who passed away in 1973. He was a heavy smoker. And back then, it was more or less a death sentence, make the patient comfortable, but really not very aggressive. There wasn't a whole lot we could do. And cancer, as you stated, goes back as old as the time of man. I mean, President Grant died from throat cancer, I believe, and we know now, what things to stay away from, smoking, diet, so on and so forth. But my question or my point is, it seems to me like prostate cancer, it says, if you are a man and you're living in your 90s, there's an inevitability of something's going to kill you. I mean, heart disease or cancer. And I was wondering if the doctor could perhaps speak to quality of life issues. I've had people in my family die from cancer, and I'm just wondering at some point if you have to give up the good fight and make the person as comfortable as possible. I'm always remarked about the fight people have in their system to live, and yet I think about the quality of life. What are you fighting to live for? So anyway, there's a lot there. I was wondering perhaps if the doctor could add his overview.
Sure. Thanks. Well, I thank you for the call. And indeed, there is a lot there. I don't know how you might want to try to unpack some of that.
Importantly, I put this whole notion of palliative care and quality of life right in the center of the book. And just to remind everyone, even accepting the end of life in cancer or in any illness really was very difficult in the 1970s in particular to talk about those things. At the peak of the most aggressive moments in this war, it was as if there were no defeated. Everyone had to be a winner, and if you weren't a winner, you were somehow a pariah. You were sort of sent away into the shadows. So we've learned, I think, over the years to talk more frankly about the quality of life. I have several points to make. The first point I wanted to talk about is this idea about inevitability. We often remark that the prevalence and incidence of cancer is going up in the world, and part of the reason is, of course, the inevitability. In other words, people are dying of cancer because they were dying of other things before. I talk in the book about how cancer specifically emerges in a kind of peculiar double negative, and that is when all other killers themselves are killed, when we're not dying of smallpox and tuberculosis and typhoid and typhus and various other diseases. And it's these chronic diseases that are now coming to the front because we've eliminated some of these acute lethal illnesses. Now, that said, somewhat nihilistic about our approach to all of this and say, look, these chronic diseases are part of the genetics of humankind, are part of the baggage that we carry for our longer lives, and we should focus on the quality of life and so forth. And this would be a fair enough set of decisions, except for the fact that cancer also occurs in young age, in intermediate age. And in fact, what is young and intermediate age is being redefined constantly. 40 was young or was old in the 16th century, in the 17th century. 40 is considered very young now. So our boundaries of what age is also moving at the same time that our boundaries of what inevitability is are also moving. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that there's a wonderful quote by Richard Dole, who's an epidemiologist, in fact, who discovered the link between lung cancer and smoking in the 1950s. Richard Dole says, well, death in old age is inevitable, but it's death in young age that we need to change. And so to some extent, in order to talk meaningfully about end of life and so forth, we also need to talk meaningfully about the 40-year-old or 60-year-old woman who has breast cancer and whether we can change her life without affecting its quality so adversely such that it becomes like a nasty end game. And I think the future of cancer therapy really depends on that philosophical future, which is, what is the appropriate end? When does one end? And how can one deliver medicines which really extend not only lives, but quality lives? And that's the real philosophical. How we do it is a scientific problem. But whether we do it or not, and how well it is achieved or not, is a philosophical problem. And that's what underlies, I think, the complexity of my book.
Yeah. We have some other callers. Next, we'll go to Champagne for a caller, line one. Hello.
Yes, this is Chris Campbell, mm-hmm. And thank you I have your book, and I've been reading it over the last 6 months, Doctor, thank you. I have a question. I have ocular melanoma that's metastasized, and I've recently learned a little bit more about Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn at UCSF's genetic therapy called anti-telomere antibody therapy. It's a genetic, trying to cure cancer. I didn't know if you know anything about that and could shed a little bit of light on that therapy and the research in that direction.
Sure. Let me go to the underpinnings of the therapy and then talk a little bit about the therapy itself. The underpinnings of the therapy are very interesting. Again, they're interesting scientifically, but they're also interesting philosophically. It turns out that one question that we've had for a long time is that why on earth is it possible for a cancer cell to keep dividing over and over again, time and time again. Even normal cells that grow, that divide, like blood cells, white blood cells, divide often just as fast as cancer cells might divide. But the crucial thing about their division is that they stop dividing. At some point of time, they stop growing, and then they die, and that's a normal process. Our bodies are constantly being, you know, cells are constantly coming into growth, and they're going out of growth, and that's, as I said, a normal process. It turns out that there are little, almost, you can almost describe them as little tiny molecular clocks that live inside cells. And these molecular clocks tell a cell how many times it has divided, what its sort of parentage is. And when these clocks finally finish ticking, a cell ultimately finishes its lineage. So it's as if there was a molecular clock in your generations, so that your great-grandfather had one version of the clock, the great-grandfather reproduced, and blah, 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 until your children had the final version of the clock stop ticking, and then that lineage was finally extinguished. So normal cells have one such clock, and a very ingenious form of this clock is a little piece of DNA that sits inside cells called a telomere. And telomerases are enzymes that maintain this little piece of DNA that is at the end of your chromosomes. It's a little bit like, I've often likened it to having, you know, that little protective little piece of plastic in your shoelaces. A telomere is like a piece of protective plastic in your chromosomes. And as your cells divide, that protective plastic keeps getting frayed, like your shoelace might get frayed. And ultimately, when it's completely frayed, the cell knows that it's gone a long time and it needs to stop dividing. So the Elizabeth Blackburn, along with Carol Greeter and Jack Szostak at Massachusetts General Hospital, they discovered this whole property of cells. And in fact, this is one of the mechanisms by which a cell ages. Well, it turns out, of course, that cancer cells have disabled this mechanism in many cases. What they've gone and done is they've said, well, I'm not going to listen to this fraying mechanism. I'm going to pretend that my shoelaces are, even if my shoelaces are ripped apart, or I can fix them somehow, and I can go on forever. And so that's the basis of this therapy. Now, that said, the theory is very strong. It's very beautifully shown in multiple organisms. The treatment, whether we can convert this theory into a medicine that really kills cancer cells and doesn't kill normal cells, remains to be seen. And whether it works in what cancer, whether it works in ocular melanoma, et cetera, really remains to be seen. And I think again, the theory is very solid, but the treatments, there are many, many theories that are very solid about cancer that could never get converted into real human treatments. And that's the crux of this moment.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go to another caller. This is also Champagne in line two. Hello. Is there a caller there, line two in Champagne?
Yes.
Go ahead.
As the doctor has explained to us, cancer has been observed since the earliest civilizations, all the way back to Egypt. But I've read in quite a few different places that it does seem to be a disease of civilization. That is to say that when doctors have looked at societies as diverse as the Eskimo or the Pacific Islanders or people in Africa, people who are still living indigenous ways of life, hunting and gathering, that cancer is virtually absent. And I'm wondering what his experience might have to say about that.
Again, it's an important question and a complicated question. First of all, one thing that we have to say right off the bat is that we're talking about cancer as if it's a single entity. Of course, it's not. There are hundreds of variants of cancer, and each one behaves very differently. Cancer is not one. If there's one message in the book, it is that cancer is not one disease, but a family of diseases. And there's the fact that we would find a single cure for every form of cancer in a single magic bullet is an old idea, rapidly vanishing into the distance. The question is, to what extent do primitive societies, and I use the word primitive very loosely, understanding it's a loaded word, understanding indigenous societies perhaps is a better description, have lower rates of cancer? Well, there are three features that complicate this question. One of them is age, as I said before. In order to compare a society that lives in a remote location somewhere to a society that lives in New York City, say, we need to adjust for the fact what is the age distribution, because cancer is very clearly, some cancers are very clearly age-related diseases. So we have to adjust that. Now, so that's one factor that's driving up the incidence of cancer as age increases. Typically, age has increased in I might call them more technologically complex societies. Again, to avoid using some loaded words. That said, that's not the only reason. We're actually becoming better and better at diagnosing early cancers, and those early diagnoses depend on technologies. So, for instance, the use of a mammogram has raised the incidence of breast cancer, and the use of various screening tests has raised the incidence of colon cancer. So, again, there are hidden cancers that we might not see unless we went looking for them, and it's important to look for them because then they can be treated. But third, there has to be a case made that there are elements of contemporary modern life which have increased the incidence of certain cancers. I'll give you two examples, or maybe three examples. One is the most obvious one, which is smoking. Smoking, which is particularly present in certain societies, not present in other societies, has clearly increased the incidence not only of lung cancer, but of throat and lip, and even cancers that you might not associate with smoking, pancreatic cancer, for instance, bladder cancer. So that one element of modern life. Another element is the use of hormones and hormone replacement therapy in women. Clearly has now been associated in certain hormone replacement regimens with an increased incidence of breast cancer, so much so that you can see this at a population level. You can see a blip, a rise in breast cancer incidence after the contemporary use of particularly estrogen-containing hormones. And finally, things like diet. There is a substantially reduced incidence of colon cancer in certain societies compared to the West, for instance. And we think that has to do with the role of meat and low fiber in the diets. There was a very famous observation made that when surgeons in the 1940s and 30s went to certain parts of Africa, colon cancer was virtually absent in places where the diet was very rich in fiber, and because of hunting, because of the rarity of meat, there was not a lot of meat being eaten. So really three factors: changes in age, early detection, and finally some features of modern life which have actually changed the spectrum of cancers from early to late years, and also between indigenous and other societies.
I find it, you were mentioning at the end of the dietary factors, especially interesting because some of the places that I've read about the absence of cancer in indigenous societies suggest that it was in fact the agricultural revolution that brought cancer and various other diseases to us. What do you think of that?
I think it depends on what you mean by the agricultural revolution. And if by the agricultural revolution you mean the consumption of meat, again, as I said, in the context of colon cancer, yes, it's important not to be too general about the role of diet in cancer. There are certain cancers which are diet-linked, and I talked about one of them, colon cancer. There are certain cancers that are not very clearly diet-linked. It's important to be specific and discriminate, I think, between which cancers are and are not diet-linked. I'll give you one very provocative example, and that is that there's been an enormous interest in the role of diet in breast cancer, for instance. I mean, does a high-fat diet affect breast cancer? And in fact, if you look very carefully at the studies, it's clear that there's a link between obesity and breast cancer and certain other forms of cancer. But when you try to extrapolate that from obesity, if you try to now ask, well, since high-fat diet has something to do with obesity and obesity has something to do with breast cancer, can one then draw a link between a high-fat diet and breast cancer? And the answer turns out to be much more complicated. In fact, the connection begins to collapse. Even large studies have been very hard-pressed to show a very clear role between high-fat diets and breast cancer. And there's a particularly moving study, I think, and a philosophically moving study that I like to point to. When women with breast cancer were asked about their history and to determine whether they'd consumed a higher-fat diet compared to a set of control age-matched women, the women reported, when they thought back into their own past, they reported consuming a higher-fat diet. But in fact, when you compare, it turns out that in this very carefully done study, the researchers had recorded the actual diets of these women before they got breast cancer. And in fact, when you compare the actual diets and their reported diets before they got breast cancer, there's no association. So in other words, the diagnosis of breast cancer in these women made them think, presumably because they felt guilty about their own past, made them search their memories and concoct a diet high in fat in order, in other words, to justify, to explain, or to understand why they had gotten breast cancer. So these studies about in breast cancer, for instance, these studies have been riddled with biases because of the way memory works. And in certain cancers, it's been much harder to put down, pin down a role of diet.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of the book The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. We'll talk more in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
The long-term future of public media in Central Illinois depends on the generosity of people like you who can make special gifts through their estate. Consider including WILL in your estate plan. Leave your own legacy and support what you love. Your attorney can help you put your wishes into proper form. For information on the WILL Legacy Circle, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-7300 or online at will.illinois.edu/support. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, we will be talking about Ivory Coast and what has happened there over the last few months. You may recall there was an election, a contested election last fall that led to a lot of violence. It was finally resolved when one party was militarily victorious over the other, and we'll try to talk a little bit about the effort to rebuild the country in the time since. We have two guests, both here from the University of Illinois, who have been to Ivory Coast over the decades a number of times, geographer Tom Bassett and his wife Carol Spindell, who teaches nonfiction writing at the U of I. Then tomorrow we'll talk about Afghanistan in the 10 o'clock hour. Our guest is Edward Girardet. He's a journalist with many years' experience on reporting on Afghanistan, and he's authored a recent book which is titled Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. He actually went to the country for the very first time just before the Soviet invasion. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can find the schedule on our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He is a cancer physician and researcher. He is an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician at the CU-NYU Presbyterian Hospital. He's the author of the book, The Emperor of All Maladies. It was just published, first published last year by Scribner, has just come out in paper and won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. Also was named one of the 10 best books of 2010 by the New York Times Book Review. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just Dr. Mukherjee, just to underscore a point, and people should have gotten the point by now, but I think thinking back to one of the callers saying that we've made strides against cancer, I think you have to qualify that by saying against some cancers, yes, but that if when you ask this question, well, how are we doing in the war against cancer, then you really have to ask, well, what kind of cancer are we talking about?
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, metastatic pancreatic cancer, as I point out in my book, the survival from that illness has probably remained unchanged for the last 400, 500 years as an aggregate. Now, again, there are cases that we've learned to treat which are very different, but really one has to talk about, if one really talks about aggregates, then one has to talk about very specific things.
Hmm. Well, let's go to another caller here, someone in Sullivan. They are next on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah. A couple years ago, they had an article in some paper about nanotechnology where they could inject a product in your circulatory system, and it was treated, the particle, that it would go to the cancer cell and either would impregnate it or enter into it or encrust it, and then they would put it in a radio chamber and would kill the cancer cell only and nothing else. Whatever happened to that technology, sir?
So I don't know this particular kind of technology, the particular technology that you're talking about, but in general, yes, it's possible to create antibodies, for instance, that only go and recognize cancer cells, and you can load them with all sorts of things, poisons, radioactive materials, etc., such that only the cancer cells commit suicide and the normal cells are left behind. Again, the problem with these technologies is some of them have panned out. A vast majority of them have not. When antibodies were first invented, it was thought to be a chip shot that, you know, you'd get cancer therapies that would come across very quickly and you'd have thousands of them. The problem is that there are still two problems that we face. One problem is that cancer cells resemble normal cells. This is unlike devising an antibody against a virus, for instance. A virus fundamentally, typically, doesn't resemble a normal cell. The virus is not even cellular. A virus is a particle, and you can direct antibodies because it's in some ways a foreign substance, a foreign set of chemicals. A cancer cell usually arises from a normal cell, and the differences between a cancer cell and a normal cell are very subtle, and that's somehow the central problem of cancer. And therefore, to find something unique in the cancer cell, which is different from a normal cell, is always a problem. An antibody that if you load an antibody with a poison, the problem is that if that antibody now goes and tells a normal cell to commit suicide, you've wreaked havoc on your entire system. And this has been one problem. Mm. The second kind of problem is that when you make such a medicine, we metabolize antibodies, and antibodies have a normal role in our immune system. We metabolize them, and often something works very well in a little petri dish, but when you put it into a real human being, that same medicine might not get as much mileage as you would expect from a petri dish. Now, all of that said, there are antibodies and such techniques which have been working and are clinically effective. I'll give you two examples. Herceptin. We talked about Herceptin in the book. It is, in fact, an antibody that recognizes something that is hugely upregulated in some variants of breast cancer. And if you use this antibody in humans, you can actually get the breast cancers to kill themselves, the breast cancer cells to kill themselves, and you can extend survival. But there is a long, long way, and I think this is an important thing that we all need to appreciate in science. There's been typically about a 15 to 20 year lag between a therapy working in a petri dish in a laboratory and that same medicine making it out into real human patients and working in real human patients. And there's an impatience about this lag, and we think that it's going to happen much faster. It doesn't happen much faster for a variety of reasons. We can talk about those. Now, one thing that's happening, which is important, is that lag has been decreasing. In the latest examples of medical therapies, that lag is, in the best examples, that lag has gone from about, I would say, 15 to 20 years down to about 5 years. And if this continues, if we can somehow continue to fuel this change, then many therapies like the kind that our listener just talked about will slowly begin to come to clinic during our lifetimes. So our job is to keep fueling that process of investigation and determination. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what we're looking forward to.
Very good. I want to thank the caller again and go on to another, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I've got a lot here. I hope I can get some of it out coherently, but... just to start with, when you say antibody therapy, are you referring to what's also called targeted antigen therapy? Is that sort of the same thing?
Antigens are what antibodies recognize. Okay. So yes, in that sense, I'm right. Talking about the antigens and antibodies. Yes.
Right. I was going to say something about this whole war metaphor again. It seems declaring war on something that's inside of you and deciding that the way to go is to see what. You know, how the body recognizes what self and not self is, I think, where a lot of the early research went. And it may not be, it may have distorted the research model. I don't know if anybody's done a study of that or a book-length study of, because that was declared back in the Nixon days, if I recall, when NIH got a lot of this
yeah.
war on.
One might say, to some extent, I explored this metaphor quite deeply in the book. So, yeah, maybe it's interesting.
I'd also wanted to ask about it's being called complementary therapies. I find that my father's oncologist is particularly close-minded, it seems to me, and I'm looking at research from Kansas University Med School in Kansas City of something called IV vitamin C, which it's sort of tainted by the whole earlier controversies about vitamin C and its use, but they have sophisticated research studies, and they are finding that it helps in some cases to helps with the chemotherapies, and it can be palliative in any event with some of the conditions that are associated with some chemotherapy. So I don't know if you can say anything specifically on that, but the whole idea of some kinds of complementary therapy and the fact that it seems that the medical profession is inclined to dismiss these, even when there's a serious research facility looking into it. It bothers
me a lot. It's a very important question. I think it's absolutely true that oncologists and the medical community needs to be more open to the idea of complementary therapy. There's no doubt about that. But I have a plea to the medical community and to perhaps citizens at large, patients, human beings, and that is that the mechanisms to evaluate these complementary therapies have to be standardized such that, such that we're not caught in a verbal game, in a semiotic game in which someone says, well, look, actually, this, we're not even talking about the same end. So in other words, we have to find the same kinds of trials, the same kind of studies that will allow us to evaluate. And if you use the hard-lined mechanisms, the defined mechanisms, which the most rigorous mechanisms to evaluate whether some of these complementary therapies have worked or not, the list becomes extremely small. So yes, there is a study from some university somewhere, a well-done study that shows that in some model of usually in animals or in cells or sometimes in human beings, there's a reduction of some factor, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there are very rigorous standards by which we evaluate whether any therapy, complementary, non-complementary, et cetera, truly works in the human setting. And that standard is set, really, by a randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blinded trial which shows a benefit in survival. If you go to the FDA to get information about any medicine, whether it be cancer, et cetera, the evidence is graded on a scale of, let's call it a scale of 1 to 10, in which 10 is exactly this kind of rigorous standard, and 1 is also evidence, but it's of much poorer quality. Now, you can publish that evidence, and you can put it in a journal, you can cite it scientifically, but it does not meet the criteria that the FDA and other people, scientists, physiologists, have appropriately set for the evaluation of any medicine. What I'm trying to say is that ultimately every complementary therapy will have to be judged by these standards, and once they reach those standards, I'm absolutely for incorporating them with any other non-complementary medicine. I mean, it's an old adage in medicine that every therapy was alternative until it stopped being alternative. Much of our pharmacopoeia comes from plants. We don't make these drugs. Plants make them. So why shouldn't there be another drug like this? But again, the metrics have to be rigorous.
We just have about 5 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He is a cancer physician and researcher and is author of the book The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. It's published by Scribner, and it's now out in paperback. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to something because I think it's such an interesting point, and I want to make sure people at least try to grab onto it, and that is that the reason that one reason cancer is so difficult is that it's this process that, well, it begins when one cell starts to grow uncontrolled. And the problem is that cell growth is a normal and essential process for us. So how is it that you deal with what is a normal process, but one that is running out of control? And there's this really interesting notion here that, unlike a lot of other diseases, it isn't really something that comes from outside, although it can be triggered by outside factors. In a sense, the source of the disease is us.
That's exactly right. I mean, this was one of the most chilling realizations that that oncology as a discipline experienced in the 1970s, that in fact the problem was our genetic inheritance, that we are, that something in our cells can be triggered. They can be triggered by viruses, can be triggered by external environments, can be triggered by tobacco smoke, but it lives inside the cell, and if it gets the right kind of trigger, then the cell begins to divide uncontrollably. And this is the difference between cancer and really many other diseases. That's the problem is sitting inside. It's endogenous to us. It's in our genetic inheritance.
Another caller here, in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about diet. Are there certain foods like kale and broccoli and certain fruits that you could specify are good to eat in large quantities to help stave off different cancers?
Well, the main rule that we know about, we talked about already. We know that there's a diet in general rich in high fiber and low in meat has a direct link with colon cancer.
Right.
We suspect that there is a link between certain fats and a certain variants of cancer, although that link has been much harder to come by. And finally, we think that there are some obvious elements of diet to avoid, again, such as charred meats. Typically, there has been an association with cancer. But aside from that, there's no specific, there's no specific magic vegetable that will.
What about fish oil?
A very preliminary evidence in only certain forms of cancer, and doesn't rise to the level of scrutiny that can be had from large studies.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. And another caller here, Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yes. With cancer, as with all diseases, the best thing is prevention. There's been a great deal of research coming out in the last 6-8 years suggesting that sufficient vitamin D staves off a lot of cancers, in particular colon cancer, but many different kinds of cancer. And I'm wondering what you would say about that. I mean, since we know that a great part of the American population is deficient in vitamin D.
An enormous public and media hype around this vitamin D and cancer link. I think there are things about it that are believable, but I think the evidence does not meet. Again, if I were to judge the evidence on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say that's still a level 3 kind of evidence. It just does not meet the kind of criteria, and we have to have common criteria by which we decide whether the evidence is rigorous enough or not rigorous enough. Now, that doesn't mean that no study magically proves or disproves anything. Studies are made as a community. We evaluate them in real time. And I think there might be something promising in vitamin D, but I think it's not there yet.
We're coming down to the point we have a couple of minutes left. And returning to this big question of the amount of progress that we've made in dealing with cancer and where we're headed. And I wonder whether now, after having listened to you and looked at the book, I wonder whether what people are going to have to understand is that, at least for a very long time, what we might be able to offer to people is a number of years of good life post-diagnosis, but that if what people are waiting to hear is that they can be cured, that day may never come.
That's right. I mean, that day might never come. But that said, there's a difference between survival and cure. There's a difference between living with cancer and dying of cancer. And that's the frontier I think we're working on. You would be surprised if one looks around of the number of women who are living with breast cancer, for instance, compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago. That universe, that landscape has changed.
And there, I wish we had another half an hour here, because it would be great for us to talk about how the standards of treatment on that have changed over time. And that's also perhaps a troubling part of this story, as we went from what was the standard therapy for a long time, which was radical mastectomy, finally examining that, the evidence there, the conclusion was that it actually didn't help, and that it's something that removed a lot less tissue was just as beneficial.
And sometimes, and this case comes up again and again in my book, sometimes doing more does not mean achieving more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what that's something that physicians, maybe the most basic tool that they had going back to the beginning of medicine was surgery.
Absolutely.
And so what they did, the first thing that they tried to do was what they could do, and that was to surgically remove the cancer.
And surgery still remains the mainstay of most cancer therapies today.
Hmm. And do you think that it is that doing something along the genetic line is really the thing where there is exciting possibilities to be realized?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think genetics is the next big frontier, figuring out which genes are changed in cancer cells and which forms of cancer, and then trying to direct medicines against those particular forms of those particular variant genes. I think that's where but that will also then become the frontier. It'll probably move into something else, the role of the blood vessels, the role of the immune system. There are vast unexplored landscapes here that we need to move on to after mm-hmm. that.
And having now done the many years of work that went into this book, what has that done for you as a physician who works with people who have cancer?
It's the most important thing is it's made me humble. The idea that, as one caller pointed out, there's a resistance to complementary therapies in the cancer community. Well, if you read the literature, it turns out that many of the therapies that we have found so far came from serendipity, came from plants, came from sources that you would never imagine they came from. So one needs to have that kind of humility and not to be resistant to new ideas coming into the field. And I think the book has helped me achieve that.
Our guest, Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, he is a cancer physician and researcher. He is assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, also a cancer physician at the CU-NYU Presbyterian Hospital. His book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction last year. It was named one of the 10 best books of 2010 by the New York Times Book Review and is now available in paperback. It's published by Scribner. Dr. Mukherjee, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. And then trying to direct medicines against those particular forms of those particular variant genes. I think that's where that will also then become the frontier. It'll probably move into something else, the role of the blood vessels, the role of the immune system. There are vast unexplored landscapes here that we need to move on to after mm-hmm. that.
And having now done the many years of work that went into this book, what has that done for you as a physician who works with people who have cancer?
It's the most important thing is it's made me humble. The idea that, as one caller pointed out, there's a resistance to complementary therapies in the cancer community. Well, if you read the literature, it turns out that many of the therapies that we have found so far came from serendipity, came from plants, came from sources that you would never imagine they came from. So one needs to have that kind of humility and not to be resistant to new ideas coming into the field. And I think the book has helped me achieve that.
Our guest, Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, he is a cancer physician and researcher. He is assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, also a cancer physician at the CU-NYU Presbyterian Hospital. His book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction last year. It was named one of the 10 best books of 2010 by the New York Times Book Review and is now available in paperback. It's published by Scribner. Dr. Mukherjee, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn offers programs designed to support residents' health and independence and to help them feel secure in their environment. More information is available at 384-0100.
And we'll break at this point for an update on the markets. We'll be back with more Focus. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. We're at mid-session. U.S. corn and soybean futures are up significantly, supported by concerns that this year's harvest will fall below expectations due to stress on plants throughout the growing season. New crop corn futures hit a contract high during the overnight session, and the front month soybeans contract, which does enter delivery later this week, hit its highest level in nearly 5 months. And corn's nearby contract was also its highest level since mid-June. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars with you. We'll begin in Kansas City, where September wheat is now trading at 868 and three quarters, up 2 3/4, now up 3.5. December, 894 up 2. March, 906 and a quarter, up 2 3/4. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is trading 762 and three quarters, up 0.5. December, 799 up 2. March, 829 up 2.5. September corn, 757 and a half, up 5. December, 771 and a half, up 4.5. March, 782 and a half, up 4.25. May, 786 and a